Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, is heat-killing performance on Apple's new MacBook Pros? Loon Balloons launching over Kenya. Falcon Northwest has some sweet systems and a new VR headset standard. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 475, recorded July 19th, 2018. Hot new MacBooks.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twitch.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most engaging, most delightful, most useful, most informative, and occasionally even the most accurate news in PC hardware. We love mobile, we love Android, we love iOS. Today, however, I do not think we love the new MacBook Pro. But before we get to a very special surprise guest, I must A, push my cat off the table, who has suddenly escaped, and B, remember the new keyboard on the new MacBook Pros? Do you remember that, Ryan?
I do, yeah.
So, I first saw this as a tweet, and you and I were saying, like, I think it's maybe that they're, you know, fixing the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And iFixit did their teardown, and they wrote up an article, The Great Apple Keyboard Cover-Up. This is back on July 13th. An inflammatory take for you. Apple's new quieter keyboard is actually a silent scheme to fix their keyboard reliability issues, which iFixit has done quite a job documenting. If you want to go over to iFixit.org, you can get all the information on that. What you're looking at is the thin silicone barrier. They've wrapped the butterfly switches in, the tender butterfly switches that are also, well, they don't like dust or people and or anything, I think. And then Mac Rumors, I see this morning, leaked internal Apple document states that 2018 MacBook Pro keyboard includes a membrane to prevent debris from entering butterfly key mechanism. Oops.
It's bad news. It's bad news that would come out. Because, I mean, look, we like it when things are improved. It's both quieter, which is what the only reason they claimed there was a new keyboard. But clearly that gasket around there is meant to prevent debris from coming in that was causing all the problems with the MacBook keyboards before. The problem for Apple is, as it turns out, they sold a lot of those old keyboards. And if it were proven that this design, you know, fixed a fundamentally broken issue, fundamentally right. broken design flaw, that they might be responsible for replacing all those keyboards, which is probably really expensive for them to do.
We should point out, the Mac Rumors article has a nice link to the Apple's keyboard service program for MacBook and MacBook Pro. Quote, Apple has determined that a small percentage of the keyboards in certain MacBook and MacBook Pro models may exhibit one or more of the following behaviors. Letters or characters repeat unexpectedly. Letters or characters do not appear. Keys feel sticky or do not respond in a consistent manner. And then it's like Apple or an Apple authorized service provider will provide eligible MacBooks, blah, 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 blah. And then there's this crazy list of MacBook Retinas. 12-inch Retinas from early 2015, early 2016, 2017. MacBook Pros, 13-inch in 2016, 2017. The 4 Thunderbolt 3-port version also in 2016 and 2017. MacBook Pro 15-inch in 2016 and 2017. You know, that's free repairs. Of 2015 and later MacBook and 2016 and 2017 MacBook Pro keyboards. Basically, most of what has that low-profile butterfly switch. Oops.
Yeah, and again, I think a lot of it is damage control on their part. They don't want to be responsible for replacing all of them, even for those people that don't fundamentally have an issue, which – you can understand the mentality of a consumer is like, oh, well, if even if I don't have the problem with this keyboard, I'm going to send it in or take it to the Apple store and get this replaced because it's better and all that type of deal. Hence why they only talked about noise levels when the new models were really announced. So, I'm not a fan of the new keyboards to begin with. I don't like the way they feel when you type on them. Same way I don't really like the way the new XPS 15 2-in-1 from Dell feels. It's kind of got a similar tactility to it. But I don't have one. I don't have one of the 2017 models of the MacBook to even complain whether or not it has broken or is defective at all either. So, but there is plenty of evidence out there to suggest that this is a wider spread problem. Ken actually had one that did this. He's pointing it from across the room to tell me. So,
is he pointing angrily? Because Ken pointing angrily is a sight to behold.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yes.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, we were joking about this before the show. But, you know, it's part of the sort of desperate pursuit of all things thinner that I think is completely overwhelmed good sense in terms of hardware design. And, you know, for example, you know, we've talked about this before. My iPhone 6, this was my second one. You can just barely see the bend on this one. The first one bent so badly I had to return it the first week I owned it. And, you know, I keep hearing complaints from people. I want more battery life. I want my devices to be more durable. ZOMG, why is this keyboard such a POS? And I was thinking about that because I was typing on a Lenovo keyboard just a few days ago in a store, and the first thing I thought to myself was like, this is a nice keyboard. You know, I was on a ThinkPad. Well, but you laugh, right? There's a reason you've carried ThinkPads for most of the last, 15, 20 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. You know, the search for thinner. The search for thinner and quieter has also led to some performance issues with some of the most expensive laptops sold in America and the world today. Joining us, special correspondent from Petaluma, California, young Leo Laporte from Petaluma, California. Leo, can you hear me?
As long as I can have my champers and not worry about the keyboard, I'm happy. Hello, Patrick. Hello, Ryan. I'm not going to horn in on your show, but Patrick, you're going to be on the new Screensavers this week.
True.
And I have a modest proposal for you, and I want to run it by... I want to run
it
by you.
I'm not eating any babies, Leo. Let's get that out there right now.
I do have to say that this is, by the way, the new 2018 MacBook Pro. And I've never been a fan of that keyboard. I hate the touch bar, too. I think a lot of people know that. I do feel like this keyboard is subtly different. And it's, you know, I think the silicone seal, which is clearly there, also has the benefit of kind of giving you a little bit more resilience when you tap. I just feel like there's such a short travel on these keys that it stubs your fingers almost. And it's hard for me to type accurately on this. I had a MacBook. I had the 13-inch. I've tried them all. This one seems marginally better. But really, the reason I'm here is to ask you about the i9. And I think you all saw YouTuber Dave Lee's review of the i9-based MacBook Pro, in which he said it was throttling. The i9 wasn't running at full speed because of heat. He used a couple of ways to demonstrate this. One was to recompile a Premiere project, and he showed how much slower was it as it got hotter. He put it in the freezer, and it performed much better. So there's the freezer video. The bottom bar is in the freezer. The top bar is not in the freezer. You can see shorter is better, the much better performance in the freezer. And I know this has been a problem. I've seen this, others complain about this in the i7 for years, even on those wonderful Lenovo ThinkPads. There are i9, I think Dell has an i9 XPS 15. There's some other ones. I don't know if they're experiencing throttling. But I thought we should test this on Saturday. Now, I'm waiting. I want to see what PC Perspective and Non-Tech, people who really know what they're doing. Not Dave's good, but I want to see some real laboratory results before I say that this is an issue. Dave said, and he's got a good point, there's no obvious redesign of the cooling subsystem in here.
Right.
Even though you've got now 6 cores on the i9 running at 2.9 gigahertz and up. So there's a lot. But what somebody pointed out, and I think this is an interesting point, and I think, Ryan, you've already tipped to this, is that when you're doing that Premiere Pro rendering, it's using the CPU and the GPU, both are pegged, which, of course, is going to be the hottest possible scenario in this thing, right?
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things I'm going to try. One is, one of the reasons I wanted this is for compiling software. That's very bursty. You know, if it compiles in 20 seconds, it's probably not going to see much throttling, and it may be a real benefit. But the other thing I want to try, this is the eGPU, which, interestingly, Apple announced at the same time. They don't make this. Blackmagic makes this. It has a somewhat, not a, it's not a top of the line. It's not a 1080 Ti Radeon, NVIDIA in here. It's still a Radeon. What is it, a 580, I think it is?
580, yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's an eGPU. And Apple recently updated Mac OS to automatically support it. I noticed when I plugged it in over the Thunderbolt, the 40 gigabyte Thunderbolt 3 port, it immediately saw it on the MacBook Pro and started using it. In fact, believe it or not, I've just been doing updates, and the MacBook Pro is hot, and the eGPU is perceptibly warmer. But my theory is, and I think we can maybe test this, it's not a laboratory, but we can kind of get some sense of it. What if it is the fact that both the GPU and the CPU were pegged, causing a huge amount of thermals in here? What if you use the eGPU? What if this is why Apple's pushing the eGPU to take some of that load off? So we're not going to do it with Premiere Pro. We're going to do it with Final Cut, because presumably that's going to be optimized for Apple hardware.
That's a brazen assumption.
Well, but I think it's fair to say that. And certainly... you know, I don't know what Adobe's incentive is to optimize for Apple hardware. I haven't seen them optimize Photoshop or Lightroom for Apple hardware. So let's give Apple the benefit of the doubt and use Final Cut Pro 10. I think most people who buy this, this is a $4,000 laptop, are going to probably use Final Cut anyway, right? So I will. I think I was. So what do you think of that? That's my modest proposal. That maybe it's a GP and an eGPU might solve that if that's what you need to do.
It solves it as long as you're at home.
Well, I admit it's not a portable solution.
You could take
anymore.
Your $6,000.
Yeah. This thing's heavy. It's really a docking station. It has all these extra ports on the back, plus a GPU. And it's not, by the way, at $700, it's not upgradable. So that's not good. But
it's good for Blackmagic.
Yeah. And it's exclusive to Apple, so it's good for Apple, too, because they take their cut at the Apple store. So together now, we're getting $5,000. This is $5,000 worth of hardware. First of all, I guess my two questions. Are we seeing i9? I know we've seen this in the past with i7, i9 heat throttling in other machines.
There's not that many machines that run i9s.
Yeah, there's the Dell XPS 15 is the only one I know of.
And most of the time they're using, they're also in larger, more gaming-centric
machines. You look at
those
gaming things, they got giant tornado fans in the back.
Yeah.
Well, that's because
look how thin this is. And the only vent is in the crack between the screen and the body. I mean, this thing is not designed for heat dissipation, even if it's a unibody aluminum, but that's not.
I look at his results very simplistically and pragmatically, right?
Right.
He rendered a video, which is something that a ton of people who buy MacBook Pros are going to do. Regardless of what software they're using, video rendering is a terrific benchmark and use case for this. And it's kind of it's impossible to me that Apple didn't do this testing with their device and come to the same conclusion immediately that, as it turns out, it's slower than the other variant. Yeah, because it is a long extended workload. You use the term bursty to talk about some other workloads. Compiling can be, but if you have a larger compiling job, if you're encoding Blender, for example, it's going to take a while.
The guy who wrote Geekbench didn't have an i9, but he did with the i7. He did 10 compiles of Geekbench and did not see throttling. So that was a half an hour of nonstop compiling.
Notebookcheck.net posted something today where they did successive runs of Cinebench, which is a GPU rendering. No, I'm sorry. It's a CPU rendering app. And so it does not use the GPU. It's only using the CPU. And it had dramatic fall off after the first couple.
I'm a little nervous about synthetic benchmarks. I would prefer to see things like the Premiere Pro.
So we were talking before the show. I had a friend of mine who who bought the maxed out Surface Book. It's like $3,300, you know, an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 925 or 965 GPU, which is not that powerful, but certainly a big step up from the Intel graphics, 16 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte SSD. And he's like, it's a dog. What do you mean it's a dog? You spent $3,300. He's like, it's a delete expletive dog. And I did something really simple. I just ran my favorite way to torture laptops, which is Handbrake and desktops, right? Handbrake, a friend of mine who works for a company that can spend anything they want on any rendering tool anywhere basically uses Handbrake. It's good enough for them. It's good enough for me. And, you know, I fired up this $3,300 machine, which had a, you know, top of the line like Core i7 CPU. It's got NVIDIA GeForce, blah, 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 blah. And it also basically has no fan. And it, within literally probably the first 30 seconds of a 10-minute render, what should have been a 10-minute render, you know, it throttled up and then it just slowed down.
Yeah.
And it was brutal because, you know, my, like at this point, generation previous Core i5 with half as much RAM was running faster than a brand new state-of-the-art $3,300 flagship machine from one of the largest tech companies in the world. It's not just Apple doing this. Like, you know, sure. Let's do thin. Let's do inadequate cooling. Let's do maybe cooling that's, okay, well, we can dissipate 45 watts, you know, for this long. And it's go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say this is a trade-off. This is a decision that manufacturers are making, as you're pointing out, right? That the number of people that do long sustained work on their machine, rendering a video, compiling code, whatever it happens to be, is small, and it's also a small portion of your time.
Yeah, but
and
if not, it's not for the a people small portion buy of your time, these devices. That's exactly who buys these devices.
Well, yeah, but I would.
That's who they're aiming at. This is a, you know, pro device.
I was working at a place a few years ago where they bought brand new laptops for the executive team, while the editing team was still using 2-year-old desktops. And I bring this up because in a lot of cases, there's a lot of people spending a lot of money on hardware, and they run Excel spreadsheets. And they use the web, and they use Google Docs, and they use, you know,
okay, but
Slack
Apple,
or whatever.
Apple
but
has a product line. They have a MacBook, which is an executive computer. This Apple is aiming at pros. And so regardless of what morons buy it, if what we want to know is if the people who are going to buy it for those purposes, the purposes Apple's specifying, photographers, sure. developers, sure. music makers, and filmmakers, if this is inadequate, then we need to know this. I would generally give Apple the benefit of the doubt on this. You know, one thing we don't know, Dave Lee's computer, maybe he got a sample that didn't have the thermal paste, wasn't done right.
It's possible. Sure.
There's all sorts of possibilities. I want to see this same result across the board with a lot of different computers before I'm going to rush to judgment. And I know we'll do an imperfect test, but I think we ought to do something like this on Saturday. On
absolutely.
I think that's a great idea. I think it's a great idea. And I think basically just duplicate what he's done and then add in this part where you add in the external GPU and see if it – what I think will happen, if I'm going to guess here, is that it will cut the difference between the two platforms, but it won't kill it completely.
Yeah.
And what I was going to say before is the professionals are buying these to do those renderings, but you're not rendering 8 hours a day. You might be – editing working in Premiere, but that final output cut render takes 35 minutes of your day, type of thing.
So does it still make sense then to buy it for the other stuff you're doing?
No.
So that's really the question. Should I buy an i9? Should I buy an i7? Maybe I should just buy an i5 because if I'm not going to get the full performance out of the i9 or the i7, there's no point in spending more for it.
Well, it's a real problem, right? Because you want the discrete graphics because that's going to accelerate a broad range of things that are going – not everything because Adobe's code base continues to be weird.
Intel's hasn't updated their Iris Pro in how many years? 2 years?
Well, but it's going to be at least 2 years before there's anything from Intel you're going to slap in the general direction of Premiere or the Creative Suite and make much of a difference. The issue is that like Ryan's right. Yeah, you may only spend 35 minutes a day rendering, you know, but if you're doing a whole bunch of processing work, it is a big deal. If you think you're going to go like, last time I bought a new laptop and spent $6,000, I cut 20% off my rendering time. What if your rendering time goes up because this thing is so thermally throttled?
Would be really bad.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, really feel ripped off.
You know, I would agree.
It should never have gone up. Like worst case scenario for me should have been like, oh, this turned out to have the same render time as the last generation quad core, right? That means you've properly balanced the thermals with the clock speed tables that you have in place for this particular design, right? The fact that it goes down is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
In theory.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there are other use cases for six cores that do make sense. Most of the most of the things we do, except for these high-end professional tools, are only using one core anyway. The higher clock speed of the i9 might be a benefit there. But there are other things you do. Maybe if I have, you know, I'm doing three different things at once and each is using a separate core. I usually use something, and I did this on the iMac Pro, and I will compare this, by the way, to the 10-core iMac Pro as well. I use something called iStat Pro, which is widely used among Mac people to give you a look at thermals and CPU performance. And so we'll put that on here as well so we can kind of see it. Yeah. I guess Intel has a tool as well. I might put GeekBench on here. I don't really like synthetic benchmarks all that much. I don't know. What do you think?
I understand that. I understand that mentality. But synthetic benchmarks I mentioned Cinebench before. Cinebench is a benchmark, but Cinebench...
it's actually
like
doing
that,
stuff.
That Cinema 4D is a well-known and used rendering engine, right? So the Cinebench part of it just lets us do it in a repeatable, you know, more scientific fashion.
Right. You know, ironically, this laptop plus GPU is roughly the same cost as the base model iMac Pro. I think I seriously think that Apple is looking at this new MacBook Pro as a reasonable mobile version of an iMac Pro. It doesn't have 10 or 32 cores, but it's. I think you're right, Patrick. If you have to carry this around, you've defeated the entire purpose of it. This is a lot.
Yeah, I mean it's frustrating because you know a lot of people Apple stopped doing really good support for Final Cut a few years ago, and then Adobe. I mean, Adobe, and this is going back a few years. That there is one application that I know of in the history of Adobe. And some of their applications are pretty long in the tooth at this point. There is one application where they went, you know what? It's a teardown. And they started over fresh. And that was Premiere. Because the original version of Premiere was such a hot mess. They could not they couldn't put a bag on the side of the box. They couldn't fix it in any way. And they re-architected it from the ground up. And they started talking to, you know, they basically went to people other than auteurs and college film students and said, how do you use Final Cut? And what do you wish Final Cut had? And then Premiere built out all of these tools for professionals. And around that time, Apple's hardware started getting more expensive again. They dropped all of their back-end support, you know, for the networking stuff, for the enterprise stuff. And a lot of people just went, whatever. And they basically, Premiere's pretty good, and they shifted over to Premiere. And when Apple does something like this, where it's like, you know, we know you've been waiting for a decent CPU upgrade for 2 years. Here it is. And it arrives. And the first thing that happens is somebody goes to render a video. And if you're on, you know, if you're a pretty frantic kind of, you don't want to, and think about that. You know, you've bought you've spent several thousand dollars on a laptop. You fire up Premiere or what a Final Cut Pro or whatever you're using. You hit that button. You're like, yeah, this is where my hair blows back. And, you know, because I had that experience. I cut my render time by 2/3 in two processors in the space of about 18 months. And I love AMD Ryzens. They make me happy. But to spend that much money on a hardware upgrade that people have waited so long for, and then to have it be like, we should have put more cooling in, really sucks. Even if it is only for a small percentage of the user base, that's ugly. That is ugly thermals right there.
Yeah,
that is some ugly, ugly heat mapping.
Well,
you're looking
again,
at right
this
there.
Is all based on one YouTuber who is credible, but not more than one, and so. You know, and even what we do here will not be, you know, definitive. I want to see what you do at PC Perspective. I want to see what an architect does. I'd like to see some people who are really doing this kind of thing. and get some idea of the throttles. I won't the throttling. I won't interrupt your show any longer. I have some work to do to get this set up. Have a great show. But so you think this is a reasonable? I gather you think this is a reasonable test that we'll do on Saturday. I'm going to go get some.
Yeah, no.
And we're going to do it not on Premiere, although we are, as you know, a Premiere house. This show is edited with Premiere. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to do it with Final Cut, presuming that giving Apple every opportunity, that's going to be best optimized for the Apple hardware, and we'll see.
It's very kind of you to do so, but it's okay to run your applications in a real-world scenario because – think about it. If you don't like synthetic applications or synthetic benchmarks, why in the world would you give Apple the benefit of the doubt by going to Final Cut Pro?
Well, because I think most people who use this hardware are using Final Cut Pro. It's $200. Yeah. It's not a subscription. There's a lot of reasons why you might want to use Final Cut Pro.
Okay.
And if you're buying Apple hardware, I would bet you're probably using it. I mean, we use it Premiere on Dells. We weren't going to buy that 2013 Mac Pro, and it turned out that was the right decision.
It was a very good decision.
Yeah. By the way, Apple did admit that the reason they can't upgrade that thing is thermals.
Yep. I don't know. There's 45-watt TPUs, and there's 45-watt TPUs, and then there's 45-watt TPUs with a discrete GPU, and all hell breaks
loose. Do you have one of those temperature guns we can use?
I literally own three of them.
Would you bring it on Saturday?
I will put it in my bag.
I've just been doing the updates, and this thing is hotter than hell. Right here, it is burning up. I almost can't touch it, and I haven't done anything but download files. So
that's not a good sign.
That's not a good sign.
I mean, that shot from Dave Lee's video where there was the big smiley face with the giant glowy spot in the middle and the smiley face, that's basically the processor and whatever venting they have in there. And that's probably a little hotter than it should be.
Yeah. Is that a real cat or is that just something you pop in and try that?
This is a real cat.
Okay. Because it looks a little like the Brad Sam's pop in. I'm just saying.
I really wish somebody quick grab a picture of the cat.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks. See you on Saturday.
See you Saturday, Patrick. It'll be a lot of fun.
Definitely.
All right. Take care.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's not good, man. It's just not something running that hot. Well, my second co-host and I, back to Ryan and I. We should point out this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. We should talk about buying a home for a minute. Because of the rising interest rate, a lot of unpredictability, people are nervous. You know, there's uncertainty when you're thinking about buying a home these days. Anxiety, nervousness, things we don't enjoy. Our friends at Quicken Loans, they're doing something about that. They're calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, your assets, and your credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. That gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. And here's the best part. If rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win. You like that thought? You like that feeling? It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. We want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Think about buying real estate and winning. Do you like that thought, Ryan?
Always.
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 Ryan's always about the winning. Falcon Northwest Tiki System Review, packing power where it counts. What's going on? I haven't seen a Falcon Northwest machine in a while. And I am delighted by the tiny window near the top of this one. Ken did the write up on this one. Was he also delighted by the peekaboo GPU exposure slot?
I don't know if I'd word it that way. I was surprised we had never actually reviewed a Falcon Northwest system on our website before particularly of the Tiki, which is their small form factor design. Many ITX motherboards, but still support for full-size graphics cards. Like this one has a Titan XP in it. Let me first say that, as often I find when you get into these discussions with pre-built systems, and this is the upper echelon of the pre-built systems as well. So, and this one has specifications that go beyond what we would recommend people install in any system, whether or not they're building it themselves or starting from a system builder. This has an 8086 in it, right? So the flagship, you know, limited edition Coffee Lake 6-core part has the Titan XP. It also has a 1.5 terabyte Optane drive in it, which is a lot. The price on this is about $6,200 as configured. If you take into account the Titan XP is $1,200 of that, and that Optane SSD is about $2,200, you're at $3,400 with just those two parts. So clearly, you know, as configured, they'd send it to us to wow us because they know that we see hardware on a day-to-day basis and they need to do something else. The design of the system itself is really interesting, though you can get it with that window or without that window. You can do kind of a black standard black paint. You can do customization to the paint. This paint, it's hard to see in the pictures, is like kind of a bright blue. They use car paint processing for this, right? So it does have clear coat on it and all that type of stuff. It has a lifetime warranty on the paint. You can send them custom designs, and they will quote you prices with which to paint or airbrush on it, different colors and options. And do you want it to have kind of a glitter? Basically, any paint option you could do on a car or anything like that, you can do on this. And that's kind of one of their claims as well. They also do a very good job with the build. Obviously, it's fair. You know, it's well cable routed, well cooled. You can see in the documentation. You can see the check. The checklist of things that they evaluate. They have a second person go through everything. The warranty backs all that up. It comes overclocked out of the box, but they configure it in a way that if you are knowledgeable about PCs and you want to switch back and forth, it's just saved as a profile in the BIOS, and you can revert back to the Falcon Northwest standard profile if you want, and go back and forth between those things, which is what we did in our testing and kind of evaluation here. The overclocking that they offer is kind of an included thing, although you don't have to get it. We didn't do a bunch of benchmarking on this because we've seen the processor, we've seen the graphics card, we know what all this is going to perform like. That graph gives you a little bit of what the performance improvements were with the overclocked settings out of the box. It's using liquid cooling, a self-contained liquid cooler for the processor. It's using a blower-style cooler for the GPU, which you kind of have to have in those small form factor designs. And if you notice in that window that's cut out, there's actually a laser-cut NVIDIA logo there as well that allows for air to be drawn into the system as well for that Titan XP to be cooled. It's a really impressive system, and we talk about most of the time when we're talking about on this machine is value for your dollar, like which processor is going to be the best. We talk about Ryzen versus this. This is not in that discussion, right? If you're worried about PC gaming and you're worried about your performance per dollar metrics, you're probably not going to build a system from almost any SI. But if you do, you're not going to get one from somebody like Falcon or Alienware. You're going to get something from, you know, CyberPower or something like that. This is definitely for the people who, in my mind, this is a machine for people who used to be hardcore enthusiasts, don't have the time or totally lost track of what the hardware landscape was. They don't want to go back and do the research. They'd rather spend the money on the higher end configuration, knowing that they get good support. They have 24-hour turnaround on RMAs. They, you know, are taken care of. There's a person that answers the phone when you call in for support. Things like that. It's kind of like Mercedes versus Toyota, right? Both will get you to the place you want to go. If you have the money to do it, there's the luxury option that comes along with it. So I came away really, really impressed with this system, not just because it had a 1.5 terabyte Optane drive and a Titan XP in it, but just the experience of getting it out of the box, They give you a t-shirt and a mouse pad and some highly caffeinated coffee grounds for you to use. And, you know, the zip up portfolio that they give you with all the documentation and the extra cables and the checklists and the warranty list are all in there as well. And it's just a well done thing. It almost sounds like we're saying it in a condescending manner, but it's a very different thing than building your own machine.
I mean,
right?
It is. I mean, I'm a big fan of you know, Puget Systems, right? These are mm-hmm. not cheap. But one of the things that's incredible about Puget is I still suspect I'm not saying that right after like 15 years. When you take a look at the hardware, right, they do good builds, they do good testing, they have great support. You know, it's been a few years since I've unboxed one, but you would get like a big binder with all of the information and the warranty information and everything in one place. And, you know, I know some of the people listening now are like, whatever. But, you know, if you've ever worked in an office with a bunch of high-end systems that were put together by the IT staff and nobody kept the warranty information or somebody lost this information or you don't know what's going on there. And to have all that put together, but what really amazes me is Puget's gone out and they have recommended systems they put together, and they have these incredible articles where they've gone through and they've done extensive benchmarking. And some of my favorite ones are where they're looking at different components inside of, for example, Premiere or Photoshop. And, it's amazing because they did one, and of course I just closed it because I can do that kind of thing. Close the windows I had open, but you know, they looked at Premiere Pro 2017. They looked at, you know, CPU performance, and you know what the difference is with, you know, live playback, warp stabilized, render previews, and exports. And from an Intel Core i7-7800X, which was 100%, and then they looked at the performance increase going from that to an Intel Core i9-7980XE, which is an 18-core CPU, running considerably slower, bursting a little bit higher. But, you know, that was 30% faster than a Core i7-7800X. And they went through and they did this for GPUs. And you could look at the difference between a 1060 and a Titan on a whole bunch of different applications. And they've done a tremendous amount of benchmarking on this. And it's one of the only places you can go because there's people have lots of ideas on the interwebs and the forums. And there's some basic recommendations you can find from Adobe. But to find, you know, somebody that's gone down and looked at everything from a GTX 1060 to a Titan V, and a Titan XP. And it's crazy, like for exporting GPU, a 1060 is 84.4%, a 1080 is 100% their benchmark. And if you go up to a Titan V, it's 117.7% for an export. So a lot of people are like, I'm going to spend $1,000 and my rendering is going to be twice as fast. And it's like, actually, it's not. It's going to be about 17.7% faster. But, you know, Puget, Falcon, you know, yes, you are paying extra money for this, but you're also, I mean, it's, you know, I would tease you about the experience of when you picked up your Tesla, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But the flip side is you also got a Tesla. You got a freaking space buggy that'll, you know, stomp on the average mythical, it's like your electric vehicle, which is like completely green depending on the source of the electricity, also has more torque and better suspensions than the vast majority of the performance automobiles made in the last 30 years. So you get a different experience. You're also spending a lot more money, and that's okay. Yeah. And in case you didn't get it from Ryan, it's okay if you've gotten to a point where you're like, I can have a relationship with my children, or I can spend 9 hours on PC Parts Picker figuring out which system to buy. It's okay to spend time with the kids or the dog. We won't make fun of you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I won't. Ryan might.
Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe. Oh, my goodness. From the products we never expected to see department, Roku. Roku has announced speakers. And I just thought that was kind of fascinating. wireless speakers. It's the first Roku Connect platform product. They're essentially wireless speakers that connect to your Roku TV over the Wi-Fi. I think it's really interesting. There's been a maybe I think it's really interesting because I was watching some friends debate over the Sonos IPO. And then they pulled out this article where a guy did a teardown of the Sonos and the latest Amazon Alexa. And sorry. My bad. The Amazon Echo Plus. And it was really amusing for me because this really extensive discussion of how the parts were molded and how everything was put together and how this is done and how Sonos does it very old school. And Amazon does it kind of new school, but mostly it's really weird the way they did it. And wow, they spent a lot more money than he thought they would have. And his end result was, you know, Sonos is doomed, you know, despite the fact that, you know, it was interesting for me because it was kind of like reviewing, let's say, a 78 Honda CVCC and Ryan's Tesla Space Buggy and pointing out that they both have steering wheels, four wheels, and will eventually get you to where you want to go. They're both cars. One's less expensive than the other and has more of a future. No, wait. The more expensive one has a future because CVCCs outside of Northern California have already turned to rust and exploded. but the sorry. I see things around here that I've never seen functioning in the last decade anywhere else because things don't rust. But I bring that up because it was amazing because, I, you know, on one thing, yeah, I'm like, I think Sonos is kind of cashing out before you know, Google Home and Amazon with the Echo devices and Apple with the HomePod kind of take over. But the irony is while, yeah, Sonos is this tiny percentage of the overall, you know, home speaker sales at this point because Amazon and Amazon especially, I think they're running like 75% and most of the rest of it's going to Google. The thing that this detailed analysis didn't point out was that how much better the Sonos actually sounds compared to the Echo, because the Echo is a weird extension that doesn't have to make a profit that makes it easier for people to order stuff from Amazon and for Amazon to exercise more control over its you know, consumer base, where the Sonos is this independent speaker that actually was built to play audio as the first, foremost, and primary most important thing there. Certainly built to a price. But it's interesting to watch as, you know, more of these products come out is we've run into a lot of, you know, the HomePod sounds pretty good, but we've run into a lot of expensive speakers that sound like crap. We've run into a lot of issues with the software. And when you start looking at the Internet of Things, I got to say, in many cases, the support on the software is as important or maybe more important than the hardware. You know, I've got a Nexus Q I just pulled out of a box in storage. And if you don't remember that, it was this really weird, really interesting round ball with a Class D amplifier and HDMI port that lasted for several weeks before Google, you know, ripped support for it out of the Android operating system. And you know, I also, you know, another thing that struck me this week was that Nest, for example, is getting sucked back inside of Google Home. You know, the CEO is kind of moving to an administratory capacity, and I just, you know, I think it's interesting that Roku is doing this. I think Roku, the way Roku runs, they will support their own products forever. I have not heard them yet. I don't know anybody who's heard them yet, so I cannot comment on their quality. But man, try to think long term and as open as possible or as multi-platform as possible when you're buying gear these days. You know, because in a world where people can think a company that did like in excess of $900 million in sales last year with a 45% profit margin, that would be Sonos, and be like, man, they're dead meat. I find, you know what I mean? I find it curious what people think is going to live or not going to live. I don't know. Side rant, sorry. but I had a lot of speakers on my mind in the last couple of days and thinking about the IPO and Roku starting to create the speakers. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious. And also, by the way, for most people, the right choice, if you don't want to deal with a full 5.1 surround sound, is to just go buy a Vizio soundbar with a subwoofer, because those stupid I shouldn't say that. Those inexpensive $275, $300 Vizio 2.1 systems have subwoofers that often outperform considerably more expensive equipment. It is amazing. Money does not actually mean the audio sounds good. Oh my goodness. if you're irritated by fingerprint scanners on the back of Samsung's phones, the S10 may be the phone you have been waiting for. And Kiff Leswing has a write-up on Business Insider talking about Ming-Chi Kuo's latest predictions, not for Apple, mind you, but for Samsung, talking about the Galaxy S10 lineup. A 5.8-inch, a 6.1-inch, and 6.4-inch screen options. The 6.1 and 6.4-inch screen phones will have, quote, an ultrasonic fingerprint scanner built into the display. And they point out that that's the same feature that Apple's given up on. And now that that maybe I got it. This is why Apple settled the lawsuit with Samsung to get access to their ultrasonic fingerprint scan technology. That's my new theory.
Ultrasonic. I'm trying to figure out what that means in this instance. That obviously the Business Insider story doesn't go into a whole lot of detail on that. I also like that it's called FOD, FOD, fingerprint on display, in their A series phones and the Note 10. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what an ultrasonic fingerprint reader means.
Well, but several thousand years ago,
we both agree that they're necessary.
What, you don't like reaching around to the center of the back of them? I've been getting ready to use a new Android phone and possibly wean myself off of iOS. And boy, I hate those fingerprint scanners. But I also hate the fingerprint scanner on the home button on this because apparently my fingerprints are unscannable. So Android Authority actually did an article, I want to say back in 2016 now, on ultrasonic fingerprint scanners, and this was Qualcomm's Sense ID. It's really weird. There's a transmitter, a receiver. The transmitter sends out an ultrasonic pulse, and based on the based on what is absorbed and what is reflected, they can determine the ridges and pores and other stuff on the fingerprints.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it is actually pretty fascinating and kind of Buck Rogers space weird,
yeah.
To use a highly technical term. something that if we hadn't gone kind of crazy in our conversation over the Apple MacBook, potential failure. I got to give Leo credit. He is giving Apple every chance to be successful in his review of the new MacBook Pro. Mm-hmm. I admire the dedication, the open mind, or perhaps simply just looking at all those zeros on his credit card bill is irritating the snot out of him. But something that I was shocked and delighted by, because I've been complaining for a couple of years now at the competing standards on the VR front. And you guys have a write-up. NVIDIA, Oculus, Valve, AMD, Microsoft collaborate on Virtual Link VR headset standard. Does this mean we'll be able to run one VR application on all the devices, or is this just something much more mundane that's going to make me sad when you tell me all about it?
It's more mundane than that. I apologize. You're going to have to be sad. This is actually a physical connection standard. So basically that mess of stuff that you see there, that is the HTC Vive breakout box with HDMI inputs and USB and power and then output in different directions. Basically, Virtual Link, as it's called, is a Type-C derivative that will be one cable from your headset, your head-mounted display, to the PC. It carries display, data, and power all in one cable. It supports up to 4K 120 hertz refresh rate. It supports USB 3.1 10 gigabit per second data throughput. And it supports up to 27 watts of power all across this one cable. And as you mentioned, NVIDIA, AMD, Microsoft, Oculus, and Valve all on board, which is like anybody that matters in the PC VR space. So this is actually a real thing that will happen. This is not a proprietary NVIDIA connection or something that Valve wants, that Oculus hates or anything like that. And so this doesn't, this isn't, in the perfect world, we'd be talking about this new wireless standard for head mounted displays. Mm-hmm. And this is not that. It's still wired. There's a lot of data transfer issues. There's still a lot of issues with the high frequency wireless stuff that is, you know, necessary to get that high bandwidth. Hard to do, but this does make things simpler, right? One cable in doesn't, you don't have to worry about it. Now, the interesting stuff comes into play of where will this cable be coming in? At the headset, it's going to be hardwired in or some kind of proprietary connection because you can't use standard Type-C cables for this because they change some of the pins around a little bit. But the chances are, if you remember, I don't know if we talked about it on the show or not, a couple of months ago, there were rumors about the new GeForce GPUs that are going to come out later in the summer. We're going to have a quote-unquote VR port on them. And nobody really knew what the heck that meant. And it didn't really make any sense. Now, with this information in hand, it makes a little bit more sense, right? Now that we might know what they're referring to. So it seems that the new NVIDIA GeForce cards will have a virtual link connection on them, which would just be a Type-C port. Passing display through makes sense. Passing power through, you can also do 27 watts. I think only 15 watts is required. 27 watts is like the maximum. Getting 15 to 27 watts from your graphics card, not a huge deal. It's, you know, if you've got a card that's kind of on the edge of the power draw that it's allowed to pull off the system, either through the PCI Express bus or the auxiliary cables, then you kind of, are they going to have to change their GPU designs in a way so that they leave enough headroom for this connection to be active? If you're running a more mainstream GPU that only has a 6-pin connector, or maybe if we get down to only bus powered graphics cards, will you be able to have a virtual link output on that? It's kind of doubtful, right? If you only get 75 watts out of a motherboard, are you going to dedicate 20, 27 of that to the VR headset power? It's going to drastically reduce what you can do with the GPU itself. So that'll be question marks there. The other question mark is, how do they get the USB data? Right, the USB data comes into the GPU on that cable. It has to get to the host system somehow. Are they going to do a jumper cable? Are they going to do a virtualized USB driver? Like through the NVIDIA and the AMD GPU driver, it creates like a virtualized USB device that, that the system sees. Something like that will have to occur in order to get the data from the cameras and the sensors on the headset back to the PC without going into the USB ports, you know, on the back of the motherboard, for example. But it makes things simpler. It makes things cleaner. No, I don't think it's going to fundamentally make VR take off on its own right. But it, if nothing else, it means more people will be more likely to take a look at the next generation of headsets that integrate this type of tech.
I'm a little heartbroken. It'll pass.
I understand. I understand.
This is episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, brought to you by ExpressVPN. Doesn't matter. Cafe, hotel, goodness help you, the airport Wi-Fi at McCarran in Las Vegas. A lot of people rely on public Wi-Fi because you want to use the internet on the go. Something as simple, though, as paying your online bill from a Starbucks can leave your data exposed. A hacker with the right know-how can intercept that data shockingly easily. Steal your passwords, your credit card numbers, your personal details. A lot of stuff gets moved back and forth. Now, presumably, you're on it. You've got HTTPS everywhere. You've got your local passwords locked down. You think you're safe. Do me a favor. Use a tool like ExpressVPN. I'm using ExpressVPN because I want to protect myself from spies and hackers. And quite frankly, my ISP, they don't need to know what I'm doing online. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, your phone, your tablet. Turns on with a single click. It's easy, people. It secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. You can safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having your personal data stolen. It's rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar. Comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And this is cheap, people. It costs less than $7 a month. A little more security. A little, you know, two Frappuccinos a month, maybe, probably even less than that. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free with a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/twitch for 3 months free with the 1-year package. That's a big discount, people. Visit expressvpn.com/twitch. TWICH to learn more. We want to thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And please, be like me, use a VPN, and do yourself a favor, support This Week in Computer Hardware by checking out, ladies and gentlemen, I'll say it again, expressvpn.com/TWICH. Something we don't often see, an Intel leak by way of Dell, and oddly enough, the new XPS 13 2-in-1, the word has gone out on the Amber Lake CPUs, or at least some specs have gone out on the Amber Lake CPUs. Andrew Friedman wrote this up at Tom's Hardware. I guess this means we're getting a new Dell XPS 13 2-in-1.
Certainly looks like it.
You know, the Chilean arm of Dell.
I will admit, it's the first time I've seen leaks from computer hardware from the Chilean version of any website. But, you know, Now we've grown a little bit.
I feel broader, and not just because of the chips. 7th-gen Intel Y-Series processor and 8th-gen Intel Y-Series, quote, Amber Lake, unquote, CPUs. Andrew writes, quote, this is our best look at the processor since Intel announced them at Computex but provided no technical details, unquote. That was quite a performance at Computex. So these are super low power processors. These are 5-watt processors. These are not what you want to be running Premiere on or rendering video. They're for basic everyday use, not content creation, unless you're incredibly patient and have a lot of time. But according to Tom's Hardware, Dell's site included a Core i5 7Y54 with 4 megs of cache up to 3.2 gigahertz, Core i7 7Y75, 4 megabytes of cache up to 3.6 gigahertz, Core i5 7Y57, 4 megabytes of cache up to 3.3 gigahertz. Those are all 7th generation Intel Parson. 8th generation Core i5 8200Y, 4 megs of cache up to 3.9 gigahertz, and the Core i7 8500Y. Again, 4 megabytes of cache, but up to 4.2 gigahertz. So that's not a 20% boost in clock speed, but it's most of the way there. Certainly better than the 15% bump in clock speed.
Yeah, the interesting thing for me looking at those specs, if they're true, on the first of all, I love the new naming scheme for the Y series parts, the 8200Y, the 8500Y. It's way better than 7Y57, 7Y75, and 7Y54. if you look at the 8th gen i7 versus the 7th gen i7, what you'll notice is you're going from 3.6 gigahertz at the peak turbo to 4.2 gigahertz. That's a 600 megahertz bump. This is the same process technology, 14 nanometer plus or what have you. Very, very minor tweaks of the processor itself. So it's kind of an interesting corollary to the questions we were going through with Leo, right? Is that
right?
You can claim as high of a clock speed as you want, but you have to get there and maintain that performance. Otherwise, who the hell cares, right? So it doesn't matter that the this actually, and again, and I have no idea, this Core i7 8500Y and 8200Y may completely run at their specifications and be fine and cause no issues. But I'm kind of looking at it, right? And I'm looking at did Dell fundamentally upgrade the cooling capability of the XPS 13 2-in-1? Probably not. Did Intel suddenly discover some magical bit to get 600 megahertz at the same voltage on a similar architecture and process node? Probably not. meaning that are we gonna find more instances of things happening like the MacBook Pro going ahead than we have so far? And those kind of numbers worry me a little bit. You know, they don't mention what the base clock speed is. They only mention the 4.2 gigahertz. Base clock speed might be 2.8 or something like that, right? And that's how they do that. And there's benefit to being able to spike very high frequencies, even if it's for, you know, very short periods of time to hurry up and wait, to hurry up and get that work done.
No, I mean, I've opened up tabs in Chrome and have my processor spiked to 90% for a half a second or so. And I get that, but
you want that.
You want that, but that also doesn't necessarily translate into meaningful performance when I'm doing, and I'm not going to be rendering video on a 5-watt part. But the flip side is I also don't want to be getting particularly aggressive with a bunch of tabs open and have my laptop start slowing down. Yeah. I mean, technically, these are all 5-watt parts, and they all should, the Dell's got engineers. I'm going to say something neat, and okay, they're probably better laptop engineers than Apple's. Or it's certainly more focused on their consumers.
They're just more realistic with how people use their products. There's always been this battle between specifications and performance, right? If you remember back in the day when Athlon was coming out and the Pentium 4 was out. The Pentium 4 was racing up in frequencies up to 4 gigahertz, and AMD's processors were performing very well. They were very competitive, but their clock speeds were lower. So they started having model numbers like the 1800 plus, the 2200 plus, and it was supposed to be somewhat equivalent to what Intel's frequencies were. And the idea then was, and it's still relevant today, is it doesn't matter what your frequencies are. It doesn't matter what your cache size is. It doesn't matter how many cores you have. It's how quickly can you get the work done. You know, if you go back to that MacBook Pro discussion we had earlier, the answer is slower, maybe, right? And in which case, that's not an upgrade. Even though it's got more cores and maybe running at higher frequencies, if it's not able to accomplish the task it needs to do within its thermal environment, it doesn't really matter. And there are times when you need multiple cores. There are times when you need one core to spike at a very high frequency. In the ideal world, you can have one part that can do all of that. But you need to be able to intelligently balance the system around it. Otherwise, it's kind of a useless gesture.
Harsh, but fair, I think.
I know none of that from this story. It's like this. I'm completely just spitballing based on the specs I see here and the realities of what goes on around us.
No, but it's again, you know. This is something we've seen a lot of in the last 6 months. Expensive, top of the line, flagship machines with thermal issues that lead to crappy performance. It's just not okay, people. It's not okay at all. Oh man. NZXT announces the E-Series digital PSUs, power supply units. I was kind of looking at this. Jeremy wrote this up at PC Per, and I was kind of like, digital power supply units. And then I realized it's NZXT's CAM software. So CAM software essentially allows Windows 10 to monitor rather closely your system's power usage. They use a Texas Instruments UCD3138, a DSP, a digital signal processor, that can monitor the power usage of the components powered by the power supply units and let you see how much power your GPU, CPU, and other components are drawing, end quote from Mr. Hellstrom. This is pretty cool, actually, because, you know, we know what the motherboard tells us we're consuming, and we know whether or not, to a certain point, whether or not the power supply unit collapses completely under the weight or under the burden you drop on its back. But this actually allows you to see what's happening at a component level and monitor the power consumption. I think that's pretty slick. And something I love is this is another power supply unit with a 10-year warranty, which generally will translate from the reputable manufacturers into a better built product with components like capacitors with higher thermal tolerances. Got to get them directly from NZXT. The E500W starts at $125. And assuming you're not running a bunch of GPUs, that's probably all the power supply unit you need. But for safety, feel free to go with an E650, $140. And then if you have all the GPUs, the E850 sells for $150. Quote, check the full PR below the capacitor porn, unquote. And I want to give a shout out to Jeremy for pointing out that people really obsess about capacitors. And those are some good looking capacitors in there, people. How about those coils over there on the left? I threw this in here because I love it when incredibly weird things actually look like they're going to become products. Case in point, I would really like to see Hoop, formerly known as Hyperloop. I want to travel at 1,000 miles an hour in my underground Elon Musk space capsule. I really do, actually. I think it would be cool.
I think so.
And this is a write-up up on Wired. Quote, loons internet slinging balloons are headed to work over Kenya. And if you're not a fan of obscure internet propagation technology, or you didn't run into the loon descriptions on XKCD a few years ago, this is pretty awesome. I'm just going to read the lead off this and point people to Wired.com if they want to get deeper. Quote, writes Mr. Alex Davies, it's been a big week for Loon. Just 8 days ago, it was one of Alphabet's moonshot projects launching antennas attached to giant balloons into the stratosphere to beam internet down to Earth. Now it has announced its first commercial agreement, working with Telecom Kenya to provide the internet service to parts of central Kenya starting next year and helping connect the citizens of a country where coverage hardly extends beyond major population centers. Project's like 7 years old at this point. It was one of the moonshot projects from Google X. I like to do this when I say moonshot. Moonshot. Although hopefully with a moonshot, you go up and keep going up. But this is, I don't know. I think it's neat. And for people who are concerned about the latency that's introduced by putting the balloons in the stratosphere, I assure you it's considerably shorter than by launching them into a stable orbit in space. And what's crazy is each of these balloons will cover something like 2,000 square miles. They can sail off for months. So, you know, one of the things that happened around the world, the United States, we think of having telephone poles and wires and cable, and large parts of the world that didn't start getting wired until the early to mid 90s, everything was done wirelessly with towers, cell towers, because the cost per mile of like square mile of coverage was something like 1/5 as much. It's probably an even bigger delta now, because it takes a lot of time to dig holes in the ground and plant poles or you know, run cable compared to putting a single tower that runs RF all over a convenient area. But this makes it areas where it's either too expensive or the train's a nightmare, or there's just, you know, like northwestern Nevada. There are several people living in northwestern Nevada. And I'm not actually trying to – I love that part of Nevada. I mean, you're looking at like – you get to this corner of Nevada where it gets real close to Oregon and Idaho and California. You're in a big place without many humans, and it's great. Anytime I can drive for 2 hours and not see another vehicle and run into wild Mustangs, I am a happy camper, although I nearly got ran off the road by a bunch of antelopes once.
I was going to say, run into it and see – not run into as in physically contact. Yeah.
No, I literally had a herd of antelope jump over a ridge and nearly impact my Subaru several years ago in another part of Nevada that is nearly as empty. But it's kind of neat to see big nature and big skies. But those are the kind of areas that it is ridiculous and prohibitively expensive to provide internet coverage. And traditionally, these areas, even in the United States, where we probably have a lot more money floating around, are pathetically underserved. You get to a lot of small towns and you may have, you know, DSL service or DSL service and one other provider because it's probably pretty hard to, you know, if you have a town of under 1,000 people, it's probably hard to do an ISP startup and cover your bills. But I just think it's neat.
I'm curious.
I want it to succeed. Because one of the things the article points out is originally the idea was they were just going to have a whole bunch of balloons that were kind of wander around the planet. And I'll do one last quote. Then around 2014, they realized they could direct the balloons where they wanted and thus keep a few over a specific area. Basically, by changing the altitude of the balloon and using natural air currents to move the balloons around. Really cool story, a really cool concept. I wish Google and the Loon project nothing but massive amounts of success. I just think it's awesome. Awesome. Also awesome, ladies and gentlemen, PCPer.com, the home of Mr. Ryan Shrout and the rest of the PCPer crew. If you have not gone to PCPer, shame on you. I'm hurt. Not as hurt as Ryan is, but I'm really close to being as hurt as Ryan is. You should go over to PCPer.com right now, ladies and gentlemen. I suspect in the none-too-distant future, you may see a GPU review from one of the two major GPU manufacturers that involves a VR port. Now, near future may be September, but I'm saying all of this because Ryan probably can't talk about it unless he wants to get beaten with a hammer by lawyers from a major
GPU.
Sure. Is there anything you can tease that's coming up on the website?
I'm looking around.
Where's the hammers? Where's it?
I'm going to say nothing that I can think about right now. Oh, we got, you know what? I can say this. We got two new HDR monitors to compare to that G-Sync HDR. Neither of them are gaming monitors, but we have the Asus PA32U, which is a 32-inch 4K HDR 1000 nits screen. It does support adaptive sync, but it's only a 60 hertz panel. And then we got in, I can't see the box. Is it an Acer? I can't remember the other one now. We have another one that is essentially the same monitor as the G-Sync display. It's 384 zone backlight, 1000 nits, 60 hertz, but none of the high frequency or G-Sync thing. So it's still a 27 inch display as well. So I'm curious to see what the differences are here and what the price differences are. The Asus monitor is only, I want to say it's like $1,200. The other one, I keep saying Acer, but I don't think it's Acer over there. But it's like $300 less than the G-Sync one. So if you want the high color gamut, if you want the brightness and the HDR capability, you don't care about the gaming side, you can save a few $100 and get it. Still an expensive display, but we're going to have that comparison fairly shortly too.
Cool. I'm excited. I'm also excited. I was laughing. We did a review a couple weeks ago of Netgear's Orbi, their outdoor satellite, and it was funny because I got to hear the reaction to somebody who saw the picture of me spraying the router for the first time, which is always fun when you get to take innocent hardware and get it wet, and for it to be engineered so it doesn't die when that happens. But if you're looking for an entry-level affordable gaming laptop, a budget gaming laptop, Shannon's got a review of Lenovo's Legion Y530 on this week's tech thing that went up this morning. And something that's pretty crazy, the Romeo Saber, which is essentially a tube, a brick, if you will. You can see it to the left of that Lenovo in that picture. And it is a giant battery pack with an inverter and a 120-volt outlet on the end. And I will point you to TechThing, TechThing.com, if you would like to learn how well that did or did not last when charging a gaming laptop. Not inexpensive, but you know, if you've ever had something where you could not get an adapter for it and the only way to power it was from a 120-volt connection, this has got you covered, and you can legally carry it on a plane, which from personal experience, I can tell you that even sealed lead acid batteries that are supposed to be okay to take on the plane, not friendly treatment at TSA. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I bet.
But I'm just saying. Just want to mention that. with that, ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for joining us here on This Week in Computer Hardware. If it's your first episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, do us a favor, go to twit.tv/TWICH. You'll get links to all the older shows and information on how to subscribe. And please subscribe and join us each week as we talk about the biggest hardware news and reviews in mobile and desktop and everywhere else. And yes, even occasionally the Internet of Things and the Nest thermostats. I can't wait to see what happens to the Nest OS next. But I digress. And seriously, thank you for joining us. Tell a friend if you enjoyed the show. Grow the audience with us. And thank you so much. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schroep.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.